And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we head into the holiday season, and thoughts of family and friends, traditions and ancient rites and rituals meander in and out of our thoughts, something happens. We feel a richness that sometimes it's hard to find. Remembering life has that effect, and today we take a look at a life well lived as we go in depth with one of the world's greatest communicators, thinkers, and spirits. Today, we take a walk in the wild mind of Dr. David Suzuki. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Last week, as we spent time with our families, it may have become obvious to many of us that each generation has its own unique worldview. Those ancient elders reminisce endlessly of a time before there were cars, living through the Great Depression. They were the fathers and mothers of the baby boomer generation, which had its first exposure to TV, rock and roll, and the Vietnam War. The S-Geners, passé now, were post-war kids growing up on recycling, multiple families, and pre-punk. And the children we see today, lashed into their SUVs, driven by safety-conscious moms and dads, live in their rooms to provide them with enough entertainment to keep them away from all the dangers that lurk in their backyards and neighborhoods. There's something awkward and painful about how each generation deals with the changes, each one hearkening back to a time when it was definitely better, when the pace was slower, when community was real, when freedom meant wandering off on one's own to explore and discover, when kids played in the woods or came home wet from plunging their way through a creek. But you see, those are my memories, which I express with a sense of loss for the kids of today. But they don't long for such, for they're being shaped by their own fond memories of the dread of having to decide in favor of the new Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, or Wii to arrive, or the fear of riding in a small car compared to the safe feeling of a giant SUV, or the freedom of surfing the web and seeing almost everything before parental controls actually started working. And they, too, will see the loss and express it to their children when the longing of the ancient elders exists no more. Some amongst us have witnessed it all, and that perhaps is the subtext to a theme of change, for the onward press towards globalization just may have worked too well, having tied us all into a digitalized, mercantile global community destined to consume ourselves out of house and home. Translation, our place on earth. Today, we dedicate this entire show to the breadth and wisdom of Dr. David Suzuki, who has witnessed so much as he looks back on his life of 70 years as one of the world's most fascinating, energizing, and enlightening spokesmen for life in all of its wondrous diversity. We begin our conversation following the news, and it continues through segments 2 and 3. So settle in for our grand perspective on life and wonder, past, present, and future. But first, the news. The scientist who applied the term Gaia to the Earth in order to help make the point that the entire Earth is a living system recently suggested that the Earth is beginning to suffer the effects of a fever, otherwise known as global warming. And just as human species must maintain a constant temperature of 98.6 degrees, and only a 1 to 3 degree change can indicate distress, while a 6 to 8 degree rise can result in death, similarly he suggests a comparison can be made to Gaia, and he suggests that a fevered earth could result in a much lower capacity to sustain life. James Lovelock, who has a unique capacity to upset just about everyone at some time or another, upsetting climate scientists with his Gaia theory and pushing many environmentalists with his backing nuclear power, also suggested that although we are headed into a fevered condition, this does not mean that measures could not be taken to decelerate the otherwise inevitable rise in temperatures, which he predicts to be as much as 8 degrees centigrade during this century, and which he also predicts could cause the Earth's living systems to decrease to one-tenth its current 6 billion human population figure. He sees us headed towards a seriously ill living Earth if CO2 emissions are not addressed, particularly as China and India add coal plants to their energy arsenals each week. He sees a chronic dilemma, as these developing countries have almost no choice about adding power to support their adoption of the modern age, adding that if either suddenly decided to stop their carbon-fueled development to lift their billions of people out of poverty, they would face revolution. Yet if they continue, rising CO2 and temperatures could kill off plants and produce famine. India is home to half the world's tiger population, which is now under severe threat from the impetus for poachers to kill the animals to sell to illegal wildlife traders. Poor forest dwellers, who share lands within the 28 tiger reserves in India, are often paid as little as $5 for each tiger killed, the skin of which will fetch as much as $20,000 in the international market. India, which was home to an estimated 40,000 tigers, now finds itself the keepers of as few as 1,200 tigers, or as many as 3,700, wildlife experts agree. Members of the wildlife conservation communities around the world are exploring ways to involve local people living in forest conservation areas in campaigns which result in preservation of these highly complex and severely threatened species. In recent months, India passed new legislation aimed at tackling the tiger crisis, providing a National Tiger Conservation Authority and a Wildlife Crime Bureau to investigate poaching and curbing of illegal trade in wildlife parts. Scientists have once again announced new evidence that may suggest that humpback whale species may share specific brain cells that are found only in the more intelligent animals, including humans, great apes, and other cetaceans such as dolphins. Scientists therefore surmise that such humpbacks are more intelligent than they have been given credit for, as the existence of spindle neurons appears to be associated with higher levels of cognition. The presence of such spindle neurons. The presence of such spindle neurons brings science one tiny step farther in acknowledging that animals indeed may have the capacity to form complex behaviors. Meanwhile, whales continue to welcome human interactions, perform in water spectacles loved by millions around the world, star in movies that become box office blockbusters, and attempt to get the attention of scientists who keep dissecting whale brains to discover once and forever whether these animals show rudimentary intelligence. Scientists have announced that male birds, which rely on a spectrum of display and behavioral cues to indicate their virility and thus mate ability, indeed exhibit much more vibrant colors in direct relationship to their testosterone levels. Thus, brightly colored males suggest a healthier bird. Sick male birds often lose their vibrancy of their colorations and thus exhibit less desirability to potential female mates. Associated with color and testosterone levels are carotenoid levels, which create the palette of colors which birds acquire from eating colorful berries and insects. Unfortunately, higher levels of testosterone often result in a diminished immune system. However, carotenoids serve as excellent antioxidants which naturally bolster the immune system. Therefore, male birds high in testosterone and high in carotenoids have the best of all worlds as their vigor is increased, their immune systems are strong, and their coloration is terrific, and therefore so is their sex life. Human males suffering from a less than satisfactory sex life just may consider a diet of berries and insects. It just may spell the difference. And for the first time, snow leopards in Pakistan are being studied with the aid of a satellite collar, which should help in learning about the elusive animal's behaviors. Snow leopards, which inhabit the high mountains of Central Asia, including Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, and India, are finding themselves increasingly in competition for food with the encroaching human populations. They are also increasingly being killed, as their bones are a component in various traditional Chinese medical treatments. With estimates of between 3,500 and 7,000 snow leopards left in the world, conservationists hope the tracking information will help understand the complex movements and behaviors of these animals before their survival reaches the turning point. The World Wildlife Fund, Pakistan, is sponsoring the studies. For further information, visit their website at www.wwf.org. And that's the news. As someone who has spent his life in relationship with nature, it's true, nature to me is like a lover and a good friend. Anyway, I've come to the realization that there are people who get nature and people who don't. It's no grand realization, and I sometimes realize there's nothing we can really do about it, although so many of us keep trying. Is this love affair with nature and wonder innate? Many would suggest we're born with it. I tend to agree. So what happens to those who walk away from the wild, who see the meaning of life locked in the cities and media and glimmer of the grand consumerists? What happened to that innate love of nature? Today, we explore the life of someone who truly gets it. And it has shaped his life in everything he does, in every thought he thinks, and in every word he speaks. Dr. David Suzuki was trained as a geneticist, but quickly found an audience for his passionate understanding of the big picture, particularly humans and animals and rivers and power, which resulted in his award-winning PBS series, The Nature of Things. He has authored over 40 books, including The Sacred Balance, which should serve as perhaps the most elegant way of describing how he sees and how he feels about our time, now, and perhaps forever, or not. So please give the rest of this show your best, because you and everyone you know deserve it. So now, we go in depth with Dr. David Suzuki. I have an extraordinary personal joy in talking with the guest who is about to join us on the Wild Side News here, for reasons that will become apparent, I hope, in this discussion. Joining us now from Portland, where he's traveling and helping to talk about many things, but including his new book, David Suzuki, the Autobiography, is Dr. David Suzuki. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
The pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
You have had an enormous influence on the planet in a lot of different ways, and I really think it just grew as part of your spirit, just who you were and how you grew up. And what I'd like to do in today's conversation, which is going to be extensive, is to, first of all, find the roots of that. One has to wonder why you had this particular fascination with the Earth and how that affected you. And we're ultimately going to end up with, so therefore, what about the future? And again, the opportunity for people to appreciate things as we were very fortunate to appreciate things.
Yeah, so I'd like, you know, I often get parents saying, now, what was it that was important in your life? How come you became this crusader for the environment? I want my kids to grow up just like you. And I'm saying, no, you don't. I'm just the result of a crazy set of circumstances that I hope never happen again. Certainly for me, being born a third-generation Canadian in British Columbia and then having Pearl Harbor happen, Pearl Harbor really was the definitive event in my life that shaped me both in terms of the drives that I have and in all of the hang-ups that I have as well are stem from that. You know, being growing up in Vancouver, while growing up to till I was six, as a carefree boy who never thought really much about being different from my neighbors, and then suddenly being told, you're an enemy, you can't be trusted, and you sure as hell don't have any rights of citizenship, even though you and your mom and dad are all born here. We're going to throw you in a camp and keep you chained away for imprisoned for the war and then kick you out of the province. That had a very, very big impact on shaping the person that I became.
And it obviously influenced everything you did, as you say, from that point forward. Let's start out with the boy prior to becoming the enemy, because I think that's where the real story begins.
Yep.
I see this image, and I kind of see this image of North America, and then it's like with the Google Earth now, I can kind of zoom in.
Yep.
And I go to some little tiny spot, some little spot in British Columbia, and that's where you started out.
That's right.
And
what a wonderful place to grow up as a boy, as I'm sure it was all throughout small town North America.
It's exactly right.
Vancouver in 1936 was a small city. I don't know what the population was, but it's nothing like the Vancouver of 2 million people today. And, you know, in 1936 when I was born, there were still dozens and dozens of streams and creeks that ran out of the city that had salmon runs in them. In 1900, there were 52 distinct salmon rivers and creeks in Vancouver. By the year 2000, there was only one. So the boy, when I was growing up, I mean, I could go down right in our neighborhood in the outskirts of Vancouver and catch trout. I could catch salmon. I'd go with my father and catch sturgeon in the Fraser River and halibut off what is now Spanish Banks, a big swimming area, or catch sea-run cutthroat trout right around Stanley Park, our great park in the middle of the city. That's the world that I grew up in as a boy, and it was a magical, magical place. And those early experiences really shaped me in terms of the things that bring me joy and the things that I find worth fighting for. And I think that's the way it was all across North America. In rural North America, there were still hundreds and hundreds of small towns that were flourishing, that were little vital communities of maybe 200, 500 people that became the hub of big farming country. I find all throughout the prairies in Canada, there are the derelict remnants of what used to be a whole series of towns spread all across the prairies of Canada. That's the way the world was back then.
And it was very connected and integrated with the world, the earth.
Of course.
And nature.
That
was the wonder.
You can't grow up in a rural setting or a small town setting without being aware of insects, about the importance of weather and encountering ditches and creeks and ponds. And I mean, I think that kids still had a very deep connection with the natural world. We didn't have television back then. We didn't have computers or anything to distract us. We had to get out and play. You know, I can remember when I was a boy, usually around 5:30, 6, that back doors would start opening and moms would start yelling, "Mary, David, come on in, it's dinner time." And we'd come out of the, you know, the little woodlot in the back or a ditch or playing out in the open fields, because, of course, back then there was no television, there were no computers to tie us up, and we were out playing. That's what we had to do, and we'd be out there whether it was raining or sunny. It didn't matter. We were out there, and I think that that's a huge difference that's happened now. We tend to separate ourselves and closet ourselves away in a man-made world. I always felt eternally grateful to my father because his mom and dad had emigrated to Canada early in the 1900s, and coming from Japan as immigrants, their whole focus was on making money and security. And my dad was the eldest in the family, and they taught him over and over, you've got to work hard and make money, 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 money. And I used to call my dad a mutant. I said, "Dad, how come you were such a mutant? Because you didn't listen to what your parents were saying. I mean, my dad always believed you had to work hard to make money for the necessities in life. But he said you don't run after money as an end in itself. And certainly when I was growing up, he taught me you've got to feel sorry for those people that are bragging about their fancy clothes or their big car. He said they've got off on the wrong track. And his great joy was nature. He was a naturalist, and he loved camping and hiking and fishing. And those are my first memories from childhood, are going fishing with my dad. And I've always been grateful to him that he really instilled that sense of the love of the outdoors. And my mother was this quiet person. You know, she was the backbone of the family, but she let my dad be the star in the family because he was an outgoing guy, and everybody loved my father. But my mother, you know, she was the first up in the morning and the last to go to bed at night, worked hard to keep the family going. And when I was a kid, I discovered a swamp. And this was an absolutely magical place. Whenever I had a chance, I'd jump on my bike and ride out to that swamp, and I'd come home covered in mud and soaking wet with jars filled with little wonders. My mother never once said, "David, don't come in here. You'll dirty the floor." She would welcome me in, and as she stripped my clothes off, she would marvel over all the little treasures that I had in my jars. You know, I remember when I brought some salamander eggs home, and boy, you would have thought I'd won a Nobel Prize, you know. "Oh, I've never seen salamander eggs. Isn't that wonderful? We'll be able to watch them grow and hatch." And my mother gave me, you know, just encouraged me so much to carry on with that love of nature. And I often see young parents in their spiffy homes, and a kid comes home with a jar of caterpillars or something, and right away the response is, "Take that out of here. Don't bring that in here." And we teach our children to be either frightened of nature or think that it's dirty or disgusting. And we begin that terrible separation between us and the natural world.
You know, it's interesting because I feel such a kinship with you, and quite honestly, my family was very much the same. My father, who always felt it was important to bring home enough to survive, but did not say we had to be wealthy people, and my mother, who absolutely loved nature. I just think that's interesting, and I think ultimately...
Are we brothers?
Well,
what's
yes.
What's going on here? We are both very lucky guys.
I totally agree with you,
yeah.
Because my father was sometimes pilloried for not being the guy who was going after all the big bucks.
Exactly. I remember, you know, we used to make a pilgrimage every weekend to go and see his mom and dad, and I hated them because they were always bawling my dad out. "What did you take that weekend and go fishing with David for? You should have been home working and making money." You know, like, they were dumping on my father, my great hero and my mentor. He was a wonderful guy.
Well, very similar. And then my mother, who just had such an appreciation. So I, too, was bringing home creatures all the time.
Yeah.
I had my little zoo and stuff.
Exactly.
But I want to move into that now because I was different. You were different in the sense that we somehow were drawn to those creatures. What can you tell me? Why? What was that fascination for you?
Well, E.O. Wilson, the great ecologist at Harvard University, says that is biophilia. Bio meaning life and philia meaning love. He believes that we all are born with biophilia, a love to be with other creatures. He thinks it's genetic. And that what we, and you know, if you take a young baby and show that baby a flower or a butterfly, or for that matter, a spider or a snake for the first time, you don't see the child recoil in fear. It always will reach out and want to touch it and
stuff it
in its mouth, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, they're attracted instantly by the movement and the color. That's what is built into us. I really agree with Wilson. I think we have just a natural love of or attraction to the natural world and other creatures. But what we do in a city is we teach them, "Don't touch that." You know, right away we're freaked out. It might sting you, or you know, you might be allergic to it, or it's going to dirty the floor. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of people I see freaked out when they see an ant on the floor. You'd think it was, you know, the filthiest creature in the world. I mean, we just teach our children biophobia. We teach them to fear or hate nature. And if you hate nature, then you won't hesitate to go out and clear cut it or dig it up or dam it or do whatever you want in the name of economics, and you won't have any sense of, oh my God, you know, what are we doing to that world that I love?
You know, it's interesting because I've been involved in environmental education in various ways, and what you just said gave me an insight, and that is the fact that environmental education right now, it's more dependent upon the parents for them to have an attitude, just like you stated, to be accepting of living life and as well to appreciating the diversity. Because if that doesn't happen, those kids will be precluded. They just will not have that opportunity.
Absolutely.
I think that's where we need to start educating people.
Absolutely. And I think you've pinpointed one of the real problems is that we've now had generations of people that have grown up in cities, in big cities. You know, when I was born, still most people lived in villages, rural village communities. But today, way over half of all of humanity in the world lives in big cities. We're a big urban dweller, and certainly in North America, over 85% of us now live in big cities. And it's easy to kind of lose that sense of love or feeling for nature. And we just continue to teach, you know, foist on our kids that flies and cockroaches and all these things we're fighting, you know, that we're teaching our kids that nature is an enemy to be fought. So the challenge now to reestablish that connection with nature is very, very hard. But, you know, what I've seen is programs to take children out. You know, you only have to take a child out to a farm, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
I'm amazed at the number of children that have never seen a live cow or a chicken and who don't understand that wieners and hamburgers are the muscles of an animal. You know, we need to take them out as young children, and it's very easy to connect them then.
Mm. I was very fortunate to grow up in the Midwest, in the farm community, and 1 week a year, I'd go out and spend a week on a farm, a rural farm in rural Wisconsin, and that's where everything began to change with the ancient old grandparents.
That should be mandatory, I think, for all kids in the cities, is to have that time at some point in their primary school experience to go out for a week and spend it out in the country somewhere, either on a farm or, you know, out in the wilderness somewhere in a camp. They've got to experience that.
This is actually fun because I had all sorts of concepts where this conversation would go, but I'm going to let it go where it goes because I have so much fun sharing ideas. I've often thought about a program that should be initiated called the Rural Urban Exchange Program, where families just swap kids.
Yep.
Just swap kids, because also the rural kids, they kind of hate growing up in the country too much.
Yep.
You know, and they need to get into the city.
Maybe. No, that's an excellent idea. I think we need as many. Well, I mean, farm experience, of course, is absolutely crucial. I found in cities, and I've done shows for children in cities, kids have no idea when you turn the water, the tap on, where does the water come from? Or when you turn the lights on, the electricity, or when you put the garbage on the curb or flush the toilet, where does it go? They have no idea. And food, my goodness, when you ask them, where does your food come from, they'll say right away, well, the supermarket. But many of them are shocked to learn that vegetables grow in the soil. You know, you mean this grows in the dirt? You know, and they're so used to everything being free of blemishes. They don't understand, you know, that, well, I remember when I was a boy, my mother would, in the fall, would sit with a big basket of apples or pears, and with a little knife, she would nick out all of the scabs on the surface, you know, or actually dig out a worm that was in the apple or the pear. I mean, we understood that other creatures were also trying to eat what we ate, and we didn't mind digging a caterpillar out of an apple before we ate it or bottled it or whatever. Now we demand absolute perfection. And of course, in demanding that absolute perfection, we get that by spraying massive amounts of chemicals onto those things. And I think for children to have the experience of actually seeing how their food grows in the soil and to realize that, you know, all these chemicals are sprayed on it and say, wait a minute, now I don't want that. I think that would be a wonderful experience. And to gather eggs from a chicken and to feed the pigs. And I remember Gretchen Daly, who's an ecologist at Stanford. she played basketball once a week with some guys, some pals around the university, and an engineer came out onto the basketball court one day and said, "Hey, guess what? I just learned milk comes from cows." He thought it was made in a factory, chemically added together to make milk. I mean, can you imagine somebody's 25 years old and doesn't realize that milk is a biological product?
It's incomprehensible.
It is incomprehensible. Yeah. And but that's the kind of people that we're growing up, people that sit in front of computers and learn everything out of the computer. You know, we need to see it, to feel it and taste it.
Well, and there's nothing like growing up and having a first experience as an urban kid, going into a dairy barn.
Yep.
And catching, you get up in the first thing in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, you're out there, it's cold, there's all sorts of different feelings, and then you walk into the barn and suddenly that reality hits you, the smells, the everything. That changes, that's a lot, that all by itself. Every kid should be forced to go into a dairy barn.
Absolutely. Because you're right up against, oh my God, I mean, this is stuff we're going to drink, and here's all this poop and pee and everything else. I mean, it's very biological. You know, one thing I've felt is that we're trying so hard now to get rid of the notion that we are animals.
Yes.
I gave a talk in Austin, Texas a few years ago, and there were a lot of children in the audience, and I said to them at the end of my speech, I said, "Now, kids, if there's one thing you remember from my talk, please remember that we are animals." And man, I couldn't believe how mad their parents got at me. "Don't call my daughter an animal. We're human beings." You know, we really think that we're somehow different. I mean, and you can see it in the way we use language. If you call someone a chicken or a pig or a snake or a worm or an ape, these are all insults because we think we're superior to those animals. But by forgetting that we are biological creatures, we forget that every bit of the food that we eat was once alive. There's nothing we eat for our food that wasn't once living, and most of it comes right out of the soil. And we forget that, you know, as biological beings, if we don't have clean air, we're in deep trouble, or clean water, or clean soil that gives us our food, or clean energy from the sun. You know, we've really got to get back to some basics, because human beings have become such a powerful creature now that our technology and our consumptive demand is really changing the planet in a very dangerous way.
And so we emerge in life onto our stage, into our moment. We continue with Dr. David Suzuki when your voice of the earth broadcasts the balance here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.